Chapter 37. Captain Hardy took Bob's altitude more carefully. "Are you a good practical seaman?" he asked musingly.
"Eh, sir, I believe I am."
"Active? Fond of skylarking?" "Well, I don't know about the last. I think I can say I am active enough. I could walk the yard arm, if required, cross from mast to mast by the stays, and do what most fellows do who call themselves spry." The captain then put some questions about the details of navigation, which Loveday, having luckily been used to square rigs, answered satisfactorily. As to reefing topsails, he added, "if I don't do it like a flash of lightning, I can do it so that they will stand blowing weather." The Pewit was not a dull vessel, and when we were convoyed home from Lisbon, she could keep well in sight of the frigate scudding at a distance by putting on full sail. We had enough hands aboard to reef topsails man-o-war fashion, which is a rare thing in these days, sir, now that able seamen are so scarce on trading craft. And I hear that men from square-rigged vessels are like much the best in the Navy, as being more ready for use. "So that I shouldn't be altogether so raw," said Bob earnestly, "if I could enter on your ship, sir. Still, if I can't, I can't. I might ask for you, Loveday," said the captain thoughtfully, "and so get you there that way. In short, I think I may say I will ask for you. So consider it settled." "My thanks to you, sir," said Loveday. "You are aware that the Victory is a smart ship, and that cleanliness and order are, of necessity, more strictly insisted upon there than in some others?"
"Sir, I quite see it."
"Well, I hope you will do your duty as well on a line of battleship as you did when made of the brig, for it is a duty that may be serious." Bob replied that it should be his one endeavor, and receiving a few instructions for getting on board the guard ship and being conveyed to Portsmouth, he turned to go away. "You'll have a stiff walk before you fetch over Calm Mill this dark night, Loveday," concluded the captain, peering out of the window. "I'll send you in a glass of grog to help you on your way." The captain then left Bob to himself, and when he had drunk the grog that was brought in, he started homeward, with a heart not exactly light, but large with a patriotic cheerfulness, which had not diminished when, after walking so fast in his excitement as to be beaded with perspiration, he entered his father's door. They were all sitting up for him, and at his approach anxiously raised their sleepy eyes, for it was nearly 11 o'clock. "There, I knew he'd not be much longer," cried Anne, jumping up and laughing in her relief. "They have been thinking you were very strange and silent today, Bob. You were not, were you?"
"What's the matter, Bob?"
said the miller, for Bob's countenance was sublime by his recent interview, like that of a priest just come from the penetralia of the temple. "He's in his mate's clothes, just as when he came home," observed Mrs. Loveday. They all saw now that he had something to tell. "I am going away," he said when he had sat down. "I am going to enter on board a man of war, and perhaps it will be the Victory."
"Going?"
said Anne faintly. "Now, don't you mind it, there's a dear," he went on solemnly, taking her hand in his own. "And you, father, don't you begin to take it to heart." The miller was looking grave. "The press gang has been here, and though I showed them that I was a free man, I am going to show everybody that I can do my duty." Neither of the other three answered, Anne and the miller having their eyes bent upon the ground, and the former trying to repress her tears. "Now don't you grieve, either of you," he continued, "nor vex yourselves that this has happened.
please not to be angry with me, Father, for deserting you and the mill where you want me, for I must go. For these 3 years we and the rest of the country have been in fear of the enemy. Trade has been hindered. Poor folk made hungry, and many rich folk made poor. There must be a deliverance, and it must be done by sea. I have seen Captain Hardy, and I shall serve under him, if so be I can. Apostrophe apostrophe, Captain Hardy? Apostrophe apostrophe, yes. I have been to his house at Possham, where he's staying with his sisters. Walked there and back, and I wouldn't have missed it for 50 guineas. I hardly thought he would see me, but he did see me. And he hasn't forgot you. Apostrophe, Bob then opened his tale in order, relating graphically the conversation to which he had been a party, and they listened with breathless attention. Well, if you must go, you must, apostrophe said the miller with emotion, but I think it somewhat hard that, of my 2 sons, neither one of them can be got to stay and help me in my business as I get old. Apostrophe apostrophe, don't trouble and vex about it, apostrophe said Mrs. Loveday soothingly. They are both instruments in the hands of Providence, chosen to chastise that Corsican ogre and do what they can for the country in these trying years. Apostrophe apostrophe, that's just the shape of it, Mrs. Loveday, apostrophe said Bob. And he'll come back soon, apostrophe she continued, turning to Anne. And then he'll tell us all he has seen, and the glory that he's won, and how he has helped to sweep that scourge new on the party off the earth. Apostrophe apostrophe, when be you going, Bob? Apostrophe apostrophe, his father inquired. Tomorrow, if I can. I shall call at the barracks, and tell John as I go by. When I get to Portsmouth apostrophe, a burst of sobs in quick succession interrupted his words. They came from Anne, who till that moment had been sitting, as before with her hand in that of Bob, and apparently quite calm. Mrs. Loveday jumped up, but before she could say anything to soothe the agitated girl as he had calmed herself with the same singular suddenness that had marked her giving way. I don't mind Bob's going, apostrophe she said. I think he ought to go. Don't suppose, Bob, that I want you to stay. Apostrophe, after this, she left the apartment, and went into the little side room, where she and her mother usually worked. In a few moments Bob followed her. When he came back he was in a very sad and emotional mood. Anybody could see that there had been a parting of profound anguish to both. She is not coming back tonight, apostrophe he said. You will see her tomorrow before you go? Apostrophe apostrophe said her mother. I may or I may not, apostrophe he replied. Father and Mrs. Loveday, do you go to bed now? I have got to look over my things and get ready, and it will take me some little time. If you should hear noises you will know it is only myself moving about. Apostrophe apostrophe, when Bob was left alone he suddenly became brisk, and set himself to overhaul his clothes, and other possessions in a businesslike manner. By the time that his chest was packed such things as he meant to leave at home folded in 2 cupboards, and what was useless destroyed, it was past 2 o'clock. Then he went to bed, so softly that only the creak of 1 weak stair revealed his passage upward. At the moment that he passed Anne's chamber door her mother was bending over her as she lay in bed, and saying to her, won't you see him in the morning? Apostrophe apostrophe, no, no, apostrophe said Anne. I would rather not see him. I have said that I may, but I shall not. I cannot see him again. Apostrophe, when the family got up next day Bob had vanished. It was his way to disappear like this, to avoid affecting scenes at parting. By the time that they had sat down to a gloomy breakfast, Bob was in the boat of a Budmouth waterman, who pulled him alongside the guardship in the roads, where he laid hold of the man rope, mounted, and disappeared from external view. In the course of the day the ship moved off, set her oils, and made sail for Portsmouth, with 500 new hands for the service on board, consisting partly of pressmen and partly of volunteers, among the latter being Robert Loveday. XXXIV. A speck on the sea, and parting from John, who accompanied him to the quay, Bob had said. Now, Jack, these be my last words to you. I give her up. I go away on purpose, and I shall be away a long time. If in that time she should list over towards thee ever so little, mind you take her. You have more right to her than one. You chose her when my mind was elsewhere, and you best deserve her, for I have never known you forget one woman, while I forgot a dozen. Take her then, if she will come, and God bless both of ye. ... Another person besides John saw Bob go. That was Derryman, who was standing by a bollard a little further up the quay. He did not repress his satisfaction at the sight. John looked towards him with an open gaze of contempt, for the cuffs administered to the yeoman at the inn had not, so far as the trumpet major was aware, produced any desire to avenge that insult, John being, of course, quite ignorant that Festus had erroneously retaliated upon Bob, in his peculiar, though scarcely soldierly way. Finding that he did not even now approach him, John went on his way, and thought over his intention of preserving intact the love between Anne and his brother. He was surprised when he next went to the mill, to find how glad they all were to see him. From the moment of Bob's return to the bosom of the deep, Anne had had no existence on land. People might have looked at her human body, and said as he had flitted thence. The sea and all that belonged to the sea, was her daily thought and her nightly dream. As he had the whole 32 winds under her eye, each passing gale that ushered in returning autumn being mentally registered. And she acquired a precise knowledge of the direction in which Portsmouth, Brest, Farrell, Cadiz, and other such likely places lay. Instead of saying her own familiar prayers at night, she substituted, with some confusion of thought, the forms of prayer, to be used at sea. John at once noticed her lorn, abstracted looks, pitied her, how much he pitied her, and asked when they were alone, if there was anything he could do. There are two things, she said, with almost childish eagerness, in her tired eyes. They shall be done. The first is to find out if Captain Hardy has gone back to his ship, and the other is, oh, if you will do it, John, to get me newspapers whenever possible. After this duologue, John was absent for a space of 3 hours, and they thought he had gone back to barracks. He entered, however, at the end of that time, took off his forage cap, and wiped his forehead. You look tired, John, said his father. Oh no. He went through the house till he had found Anne Garland. I have only done one of those things, he said to her. What, already? I didn't hope for or mean today. Captain Hardy is gone from Possham. He left some days ago. We shall soon hear that the fleet has sailed. You have been all the way to Possham on purpose? How good of you. Well, I was anxious to know myself when Bob is likely to leave. I expect now that we shall soon hear from him. 2 days later he came again. He brought a newspaper, and what was better, a letter for Anne, franked by the first lieutenant of the Victory. Then he's aboard her, said Anne, as she eagerly took the letter. It was short, but as much as she could expect in the circumstances, and informed them that the captain had been as good as his word, and had gratified Bob's earnest wish to serve under him. The ship, with Admiral Lord Nelson on board, and accompanied by the frigate Eurylus, was to sail in 2 days for Plymouth, where they would be joined by others, and thence proceed to the coast of Spain. Anne lay awake that night thinking of the Victory, and of those who floated in her. To the best of Anne's calculation, that ship of war would, during the next 24 hours, pass within a few miles of where she herself then lay. Next to seeing Bob, the thing that would give her more pleasure than any other in the world was to see the vessel that contained him, his floating city, his sole dependence in battle and storm, upon whose safety from winds and enemies hung all her hope. The morrow was market day at the seaport, and in this, she saw her opportunity. A carrier went from over calm but 6 o'clock thither, and having to do a little shopping for herself, she gave it as a reason for her intended day's absence, and took a place in the van. When she reached the town, it was still early morning, but the borough was already in the zenith of its daily bustle and show. The king was always out of doors by 6 o'clock, and such cock-crow hours at Gloucester Lodge produced an equally forward stir among the population. She alighted, and passed down the esplanade, as fully thronged by persons of fashion at this time of mist and level sunlight as a watering place in the present day is at 4 in the afternoon. Dashing bucks and beaux in cocked hats, black feathers, ruffles, and frills, stared at her as she hurried along. The beach was swarming with bathing women, wearing waistbands that bore the national refrain, "God save the king," apostrophe in gilt letters. The shops were all open, and Sergeant Stanner, with his sword stuck banknotes and heroic gaze, was beating up a 2 guineas and a crown, the crown to drink His Majesty's health. She soon finished her shopping, and then, crossing over into the old town, pursued her way along the coast road to Portland. At the end of an hour as he had been rowed across the Fleet, which then lacked the convenience of a bridge, and reached the base of Portland Hill. The steep incline before her was dotted with houses, showing the pleasant peculiarity of one man's doorstep being behind his neighbor's chimney, and slabs of stone as the common material for walls, roof, floor, pigsty, stable manger, door scraper, and garden stile. Anne gained the summit, and followed along the central track over the huge lump of freestone which forms the peninsula, the wide sea prospect extending as she went on. Weary with her journey, she approached the extreme southerly peak of rock, and gazed from the cliff at Portlandville, or Beale, as it was in those days more correctly called. The wild, herbless, weather-worn promontory was quite a solitude. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.